get to turn the page a little bit. For the last 7 weeks, we've been talking about the Sermon on the Mount with Jesus's message to all of us. And we're going to take a step back in time, several hundreds of years back to the time of Daniel. And we're going to be talking about Daniel for the next 6 weeks. It's a fascinating discussion. Of course, people who remember their early days in Sunday school, when we talk about Daniel and his visions and his time in the lion's den and all of the great escapades that Daniel went through. He's a fascinating character that we read. But it's fascinating to me even more is that how little we know about the man. I thought, purpose of my heart this week, to study who Daniel was, because I never really thought about him. And then you realize there's not a whole lot that we know about him. I mean, there's just not information in the book that he wrote. He doesn't tell you a lot about his birth or his upbringing or who his father was or any of those things. When we read the rest of the scriptures, we realize that the name Daniel is identified at different times. Ezekiel will mention him. Ezra will mention him one time. Jeremiah will mention him one time. And of course, the greatest authenticator is Jesus himself will mention him. Talking about end days and all of that, he'll mention the prophet Daniel. Daniel is considered a prophet because he will speak about prophetic things. He will see visions, and in those visions, he will be able to explain or tell us things that are going to be taking place. And we'll talk about all that throughout these 6 weeks. But the first week, which is today, we're going to be introducing ourselves to the day and times of Daniel. What is he going through? What is he living in? What's going on in Israel, or in his case, Judah at the time? And it'll be a fascinating, or it's interesting anyway, because when I look at Daniel, not only do we not know much about his history, but we don't know much about don't really know anything about how he died, when he died, anything like that. All we know is that when he was taken to Babylon, which is modern day Iraq, he was basically kept there throughout his whole life. I've always, I guess, thought in my mind that eventually he would made his way back to Jerusalem when to rebuild the temple, when Cyrus the Great allowed people to go back. But he did not. He lived his rest of his days in Babylon and died there. And we don't know how he died, although there have been what I call secular reports, people like Josephus and historians and all of this that would claim that he was put to death by Haman. Remember Haman, the guy that in the book of Esther wanted to destroy all the Jews? This was when the Persians ruled, and Daniel would not only be a helper towards King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonian Empire, but he will also live all the way into the Persian Empire and be taken to their headquarters and be a benefit to their king. But that Haman may have been the one who put Daniel to death. I also found it interesting that there are six different cities in the Middle East area that claim to have the tomb of Daniel. Three of those cities are in modern day Iraq. Two of those cities are in Iran. And then one city is in everyone's bucket list to travel, Uzbekistan. If you ever want to go to Uzbekistan, you could visit maybe their rendering of where the tomb of Daniel is. But the most famous one is in southern Iran, just across the Persian Gulf there, where it's a place called Susa, and they've erected a temple and a monument to the prophet Daniel. But we have no idea how he died or when he died or where he's buried or if they've even got the correct bones in the grave. But then none of that is necessarily important, but it's just all of interest when we're talking about who this man was and how important he was to people of our faith. Let's go to the Lord in prayer to praise for who you are, for what you've done for us already, for what you have told us you are going to do for us in the present and what you are going to do for us in the future. Lord, how can we not put our trust and faith in you when we know that your promises are true and that you love us so supremely, that you care for us and you provide direction for us, and that you want to touch us when we're down, when we're hurting, when we're depressed, when we're off kilter. Lord, you're there to try to straighten us up, Lord, and we just thank you for that. And we ask, God, for those that are in need in our congregation, our body of believers here, Lord, that are in need of a touch, God, people who couldn't be here today and recovering, recuperating, those who are down in their bodies today, Lord, we just ask, God, that you would touch them, help them, God, make this a good day for them, Lord, that they may focus on you and what you've already done for all of us through the stripes on your back. And Lord, we just thank you for that, and we just receive it in the name of Jesus, and we just ask, God, for your favor upon us this day. Help me to teach this lesson on Daniel. Not necessarily to give praise to Daniel, but to realize that the book of Daniel is about you. It's like every book in the Bible, Lord. It's all about you and what you have done, and we just thank you for that. We thank you that we can continually learn from you to affect and impact our daily lives here in this present time. We thank you for that, Lord, and we just pray for the continuation of the service today. We thank you for those that will be baptized. We ask, God, that it would be a monumental time for them, Lord, and a life-changing time that they may understand and know the significance of what they're about to do. And we just thank you for it. We ask all these things in the name of Jesus and give you praise for all. Amen. All right, faithful to God in Babylon. The backstory of Babylon, we know that King David, when he came to power, he established the nation of Israel and put Jerusalem as the capital city. This was something that he knew from a young man. As a young boy, he knew that Jerusalem was going to be the city of God, the place where God was going to place his temple. And when he became king, he certainly made that happen. And Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel for the longest time. But after King Solomon, his son, died, we know that the nation of Israel was split in half. We've talked about it many times here in Sunday school, where the northern half made up 10 of the 12 tribes. They took the name of Israel and made their capital in Samaria, and then that only left Judah and Benjamin to be the southern two tribes, and they took the name of Judah, and their capital city was Jerusalem. Well, after 19 kings in the northern tribes, after 19 horrible kings, misdirected and led the children of Israel into idolatry, the Assyrian nation has come down and destroyed the northern kingdom. They have destroyed them after 19 horrible kings, and they have dispersed. They call it the diaspora. They've dispersed the Jews of that northern tribes into all parts of the Assyrian world at that time. A couple hundred years later, this nation of Babylon has become the world power, and they have a young king called Nebuchadnezzar, and he has some problems with Egypt. Egypt is the other power far to the south of Babylon, and they are battling and bantering back and forth. And the tribe of Judah, or the nation of Judah, the kingdom of Judah, is just nestled between the two powers. And Judah has about 20 kings during this time, and only seven of them are good. The rest of them are bad, and they lead the nation of Judah into idolatry. God sends the prophet Jeremiah to tell them and prophesies for 23 years. Jeremiah does this. He tells them that God's going to punish us because we're worshiping idols. We're not following him, and God's going to punish us. And nobody, that's why they call Jeremiah the weeping prophet, nobody ever listened to this guy. They never in 23 years did anything to adhere to what he was crying out and telling them, even to the point where he named the nation that was coming. He even told them that Babylon is going to come and take over this place, and even told them how many years they were going to be captive. He says, they're going to hold you captive for 70 years. This is Jeremiah talking. Nobody listened to him. And that's going to come to pass, and it's going to come to pass during Daniel's day. Because as Nebuchadnezzar takes the reins, and he's battling Egypt, he goes down to battle Egypt and whip Egypt, and he walks right past Judah. And on his way back, God has directed King Nebuchadnezzar, a paganistic king. He's directed Nebuchadnezzar, on your way back, go ahead and besiege Jerusalem. I'm going to bring to pass what my prophets have taught my people for their lack of attention to me and their idolatry. So Nebuchadnezzar, on his way back, he goes ahead and starts a campaign of destruction for Judah. Now, the interesting or weird part of this is Nebuchadnezzar really doesn't have a lot of problem with Judah. It's a nation at that time that he's not worried about. So he just besieges it. He wraps his army around the city and squeezes it. But he does something unusual. The king at that time, which is a guy named Jehoiakim, relinquishes power somewhat to, this is one reason that Nebuchadnezzar didn't just sack the city, is he relinquishes power to him. Jehoiakim's going to stay in power for 11 years. But in the third year of his reign, he's going to say, all right, let us be a servant of Babylon. We'll pay you tribute, taxes every year. We'll do your bidding. We'll do everything for you. And Nebuchadnezzar basically says, we'll do that, but I will do something to you. I am going to take some of your best and brightest out of your nation, and they're going to become my servants in Babylon, 900 miles away. And while I'm there, I'm going to take a lot of your treasure and all this kind of stuff. He'll do that, and he'll destroy Judah in three different waves. And this is important to understand the timing. That's why I'm spending so much time on it with Daniel this morning. Is the first wave, he comes in and he besieges the city and he takes out the young men of nobility. Nobility is usually meaning of royalty, of heirs of a king. We don't know anything about Daniel's history or ancestry, but it is depicted, or is it, it's assumed at times, that this great man of name Daniel most likely could have been a descendant directly out of David. All right, because David had many wives, he had many concubines, he had many sons and daughters, and David was hundreds of years ago, but Daniel could have, as well as the three Hebrew boys that would go with Daniel, they could have been out of nobility or of the royal lineage of David. All right, so Nebuchadnezzar is going to take these sons of nobility, and we don't know how many of them, it was a lot more than just Daniel, but he's going to haul them all the way to Babylon, and he's also going to take some part of the treasury out of the temple there on the Temple Mount. Some of the stuff that he would have known. Now, the reason he knew about these treasures is that years earlier, we had a king in Judah called Hezekiah. He was a good king. He was a good man. But in his old age, he made a fatal mistake when some Babylonian armies came by. They weren't ready to. They were bantering with Judah, and to pacify them, Hezekiah actually brought in their officers and says, "Look at all our treasures." He showed them what was in the temple. He showed them what was in the palace and all that. And they go back and tell Nebuchadnezzar, "You ought to see the treasures in this church or in this temple." So years later, Nebuchadnezzar is ready to take some of the nobility out. And he goes, wait a minute, this is the place I remember getting the report about all their treasure. So he starts taking out of the temple several things that are very valuable. So that's where we're set up. Now, in Daniel's day, he's got some contemporaries with him, some companions. We know of Ezra. We know of Nehemiah. We know of Esther. In the life of Daniel, all of these people, Ezekiel the prophet, Jeremiah the prophet, Isaiah was just before Daniel. But all these guys, you know, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, all of them were living during the time of Daniel. They were all living together, prophesying together. And, you know, that's important to know because that kind of sets the stage of where we are. Now, with that background, let's get into today's lesson to figure out what's going on exactly with what's happening and set the stage for Daniel. So chapter 1, Daniel's going to set this up, and he goes, in the third year of an 11-year reign, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, that's Nebuchadnezzar, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, which is Babylon, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Aspenaz, the master of his eunuchs. Eunuchs there were servants of the king. And they were called eunuchs for a reason, but they were mainly servants of the king, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed, the king's descendants. That's where they believe, and of the princes. That's where we believe that a lot of the people, the young men that were taken out of Jerusalem, were of King David's nobility, of his descendancy, okay, of the king's seed. Now, I want to read verses 4 and 5. They're very important. And for lack of space, they have left it out of your quarterly. But in verse 4 and 5, it says, I want you to bring the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish. He's telling the prince of his servants, I want you to choose out of all the nobility that we brought out of Jerusalem. I want you to pick the young men who have no blemish. They're going to be good looking guys because they're going to serve him. They're going to be in his palace, and he's wanting them to look the best of anybody coming out of Jerusalem. Well favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Now, this is interesting. Not only does he want the best and brightest, he wants them to look to be the best and brightest, because they're going to be under him, and they have to be very intelligent. And I don't know, we don't know what kind of testing they gave these young men or whatever, how they separated, you know, all the nobility that they brought out, you know, how they separated them. But we do know that they were not only good looking, but they were very well educated, very well knowledge, even as he would even pin down into the sciences of the day. Now, this is a well-educated class of young men that he is choosing. And Daniel and the three Hebrew boys, as we'll name them later, are part of this well-educated, good-looking class of nobility that have been taken out of Jerusalem and marched the 900 miles to Babylon, north into Babylon. All right, it takes about 4 months to get there, and they're there. So as this happens, he wants them to do something else. He's going to teach them, this is where the education part, we're going to teach them the language of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans was the largest ethnic group of the Babylonians. It was probably the ancestry of the Babylonians. They had most of the knowledge. They were considered the most knowledgeable group in the land of Babylon. And they would we would call them diviners and magicians and people who would tell the future. These are the wise men of Babylon, and they would call them the Chaldeans. And the king's purpose is he's going to teach these men from Jerusalem the language of the Chaldeans. So after that, verse 5 says, and the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank. So nourishing them for 3 years, that was his purpose. For 3 years, he's going to give them the king's meat and the wine which he drank, that at the end of those 3 years, they might stand before the king. Now, this sets up the whole story today of what we're talking about with Daniel. This is going to kind of foreshadow everything that we know about Daniel, because not only has King Nebuchadnezzar said, here's what I'm going to do, but here's why I'm going to do it. I'm going to educate these people in the languages and the sciences of the Chaldeans, and because I want them to look the healthiest and represent me as my servants, I'm going to feed them for 3 years a daily rationing of the same meat that I eat. And they're going to drink of the best wines that I drink of. I'm going to do this to these guys. These are captured slaves, but he is trying to prime these young men into being something that's reflective of him. They're going to stand before the king, and he wants them to look better than his own people at times. All right, he's taking the best of another nation and turning them into something that he wants. And this is a key point for us today, not just to read of what happened, but to understand that Babylon is a prototype of the world. We are in the world, but we are not of the world as Christians. Just as Daniel here has to look at himself and say, I'm of God's, of the promised land. That's where I'm from. That's my native home. That's where God has established me. I am of Israelite heritage, and I'm in a strange land 900 miles away, but I'm not a part of Babylon. I may be in Babylon. I may be surrounded by Babylon, but I'm not Babylonian. All right, I'm not going to conform to the world or to the world that I'm in, which is Babylon. So it's interesting when the king says, I want you to feed them this dinner or this daily ration, we have to understand that back in those days, not everyone, most people did not live on a daily ration of meat. Only the rich ate meat back then. People would eat on whatever forage they could grow or collect. They would eat on vegetables and things of this nature. And it's interesting as we get into this is that apparently you could tell just walking through the streets of Babylon who was rich or poor by their physical nature. A lot of times because the more healthier looking ones were typically the richer ones because the meat was the protein that built their muscle mass and all of that. And if you didn't have that protein and you lived off the vegetables and all that, you may not have taken on the healthy appearance as someone who was full of protein. Now, in today's world, vegetarians look just as healthy, if not healthier, than the rest of us. But there's supplements for protein that they get in today's world. Back then, they really didn't. If you had only vegetables to eat, you didn't eat a lot. And you were very frail looking at times. And what the king doesn't want that, so he's fattening them up. He's going to give them protein for their muscles, and he's wanting them to look like somebody appropriate for the king's palace, all right? So that's the part of being in the world that the king is wanting them to do. So with that, we go further in verse 6, and it says, "Now among these, among all the people, all the noble tribes, all these young people that were brought in, among all of them, there were the children of Judah, there was Daniel, and then three guys we never heard of, one named Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah." Now, the reason we don't ever heard of these guys is because today, ever since our days in Sunday school now, we know them by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. All right, that's how we name them today, maybe because it rolls off the tongue easier than these three that I just tried to name. That's probably more basic than anything. But their Jewish names were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, out of these, unto these four that they were selected out of all the noble young men, the prince of the eunuchs gave names to them. Now, you have to look at the first thing that they're doing. They're breaking down the identity of these individuals that they've brought from Jerusalem. That was the first indoctrination attempt, is they were going to change their names. You're no longer having the name that you were given. Your name given to you by your parents is over. You're now Babylonian. We're giving you Babylonian names. And unto them, the prince of the eunuchs gave the names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, he gave the name of Shadrach, and to Mishael, of Meshach, and of Azariah, of Abednego. Now, if you look at this, names meant a lot back then, more so than we depict them today. The name meant a whole lot. You know, your name depicted who you were. It identified you. When people heard your name, as they do today, their mind triggers a reputation that's attached to that name, the knowledge that's attached to that name. How do I know that person? All these things, your name means a lot, and the reputation of your name is priced greater than rubies, all right? So the first thing they're wanting to do is they know that their names, these Hebrew boys, their names were associated with their God. To give an example, Daniel means God is my judge. Hananiah means beloved by the Lord. Mishael means who belongs to God. Azariah means the Lord is my help. These are all names that have an identification with the God of the Hebrews. And the first order is given to this head master of the servants is change their names. Give them Babylonian names. And these names were all the names that they gave them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Belteshazzar. They were all names of the gods or helpers of the gods of Babylon. All right. Now, it's interesting to me that Daniel nor the three Hebrew children opposed or went after or argued against the names being changed. They didn't oppose this. They didn't go after that. Daniel, in all of his integrity, was willing to be called anything they were going to call him. His name wasn't, in Babylon, didn't prove his identity like they were trying to prove his identity. It was going to change who he was, whatever they called him. So that wasn't the hill he was going to die on. That wasn't the hill he was going to fight on, is changing the name. So with that, they even started to educate these guys in the learning and the sciences of the Chaldeans. And that didn't bother Daniel or the three Hebrew boys. They were willing to learn. They were willing to be educated further, even into the Babylonian sciences and knowledge of the day of that they were living. So that part of it wasn't a problem for them. But when it came to the king saying, I want these young men to look like me, to look as a representative of me, and I will do this by feeding them, putting inside of them my meat and my drink. That's what I want to do to make them acquiesce to being Babylonian, is what they eat and drink. And Daniel says, no, I will not do that. Now, we know that Daniel, being Hebrew, was still living under the law of God, the Mosaic law, and the law of God certainly gave a list of certain meats that they were not to eat of, pork being the main one, but there were other meats that they were to abstain from. And we can only assume that part of the meats that were offered to them may have been those that were prohibited by Jewish law. All right, so we're assuming that Daniel is saying, no, we will learn your we'll be educated in your public schools or whatever, what you're going to learn, teach us. We'll even let you change your name. That don't affect who I am here in Babylon. But what I take into my body is against the laws of my God, and I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to sacrifice my principles of walking with my Lord based on you just wanting us to be like Babylonians. So that's the stand that they're taking. So in verse number 8, it says, but Daniel purposed, or set in stone, he made a declaration in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested, it's interesting, of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now what does that mean that he requested? He goes to the master of the eunuchs, the guy who's been given a command by the king to feed these boys a daily ration of this meat and drink. And Daniel has purpose in his heart, I'm not doing it. So he's going to the master and he's going to say, he's going to request not to defile himself. Now, if you know the ideology of the slave versus the master, you don't make requests of what you're not going to do when the king hands down the edict that this is what I want to happen to these boys. But number 9 tells us a little bit about why I said earlier in the prayer that the book of Daniel is not necessarily only about Daniel, it's about God. God's all in the book of Daniel. Daniel's making certain decisions, but God's on the forefront making things happen before Daniel even makes his decisions. So in verse 9, now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. That tender love has been changed to goodwill in the New King James. In other words, bringing into favor and goodwill among this very master of the eunuchs, this chief of the eunuchs who is in charge of fattening these boys up. God has gone ahead of Daniel, knowing what Daniel's already going to do in his heart. He knows Daniel's going to take a stand saying, I'm not eating of the king's meat. The king's meat was probably offered to idols, which was often what they did. They would sacrifice when they killed their fatted calf or whatever, or their pig or whatever they would eat. They would offer it to the idols, and Daniel wanted no part of that, as well as it being against the Mosaic law. So God has gone in front of Daniel and prepared the heart of the servant, or the master of the servants of this guy named Melzar. And he basically, by finding favor with him, he is allowing Daniel to make a very strange request. So then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He is saying in the King James, prove thy servants, or in the New King James, test your servants. Put us to the test. Put me to the test of what I'm offering here. This is interesting because Daniel was not taking a stand and saying, I will not, by God's grace, I will not eat of your food. I will not do this. I'm taking a stand. I'm rebelling against everything that you're commanding. Instead, he knows he has favor with this prince of the eunuchs, and he's going to go and make a request, and he's going to say, I've got something I want you to test me on. I want to try something. I'm going to do something, but I'm going to want you to put me to a test. And I want you, I'm going to even ask you to just to give me a short amount of time, and I'll prove myself of what I'm going to do. So he says, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, for 10 days. 10 days is all I'm asking for. And let us, and let them give us pulse or vegetables, mashed up, watered down vegetables to eat and water to drink for 10 days. We're not going to eat your meat. We're not going to drink your wine. We're going to mix up all these vegetables into a porridge or a pulse, and we're going to eat that and drink water for 10 days while the rest of these guys are all eating the fatted meat. And I want you to test us. Then let our appearance or our countenance be looked upon before thee. Look at us after 10 days. And if the appearance or the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. And you know, we know what he's doing. He's basically saying, I want you to put me to the test. Let us eat the vegetables. You continue to feed the other guys all the meat and the drink that the king wants them to have. And after 10 days, you put us side by side and see what we look like. And if we look emaciated and if we're way underfed and we look sickly, then I lose. This was the confidence that Daniel had in God. This was the confidence that Daniel had in taking a bold stand. So much confidence that he wasn't going to be belligerent with the prince. He had favor with the prince. He knew he did. And he, by keeping that favor, he was saying, now you trust me, and I know you do. We got favor with you. Do this for me. Just put me to the test for 10 days. Because remember, the king says, I'm going to give you 3 years. And after 3 years, you're going to line these young men up, and I want them to see, I want to see these great athletic-looking guys with, you know, they're going to look great, they're going to appear great, and I want them to be fully knowledgeable. And he doesn't want, the eunuch says, I don't want four of you to walk in there, you know, struggling to even stand up, you're so weak. So what, you know, 10 days is a compromise that Daniel was making here, knowing that he has favor with the prince. So in verse 14, he says, so he consented to them in this matter and proved them or tested them for 10 days. I want to read 15 and 16. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances or their appearance appeared fairer, more fair, and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. They appeared better looking and more robust and healthy than the people who had been eating the king's meat in 10 days. Thus, Melzar, the guy that's in charge of them, took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse. He did this for the remaining three years of what they were going to have to do. They were going to basically eat this porridge or this pulse or this vegetables and drink water for 3 years while the others were being fattened up. You know, we realize that Daniel chose the most important part of his faith in God was not necessarily the changing of the name, the learning of the being taught things that were basic or were knowledgeable of the Babylonians, but what would actually go into his body? What would he be acquiescent to when he ate of a portion of meat that had been sacrificed to idols and things? He took the stand on that, and God delivered him from it. So when we get to that point, we realize that God has done a miracle by just paving the way for Daniel to make this. So in verse 17, it says, and as for these four children, these three Hebrew boys and Daniel, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. God even allowed the learning and wisdom that they were given in the language of the Chaldeans. God allowed them and even gave them additional wisdom. Now, it's important to know this. They were being taught the same things as the other young men that were taken out of Jerusalem. They were in the same classrooms being taught the same things. But God, here again, the book of Daniel is about God. God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and he gave Daniel something special. Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. He had a gift in his spirit here that God gave him specifically to understand visions and dreams. And this sets the stage for the entire book of Daniel. If someone were to ask us, what do we know about Daniel? Most of us would say, well, he was an interpreter of dreams and visions. He was given the supernatural ability to take a vision and describe exactly what it meant and how it was going to affect the future. Next week's lesson is going to be talking about this first time where he's going to go before Nebuchadnezzar and give that interpretation of a nightmare or a vision that Nebuchadnezzar is having. And no one else, even the most masterful and knowledgeable of all the wise men of Babylon, can understand it. But God has given Daniel the understanding, and he's leading Daniel, and he's going to be able to tell the king what this is. So this, not only are these four children learning more than just what the books on the Chaldeans are teaching all the rest of them, but God has given them more skill and knowledge, and particularly for Daniel. We know what the three Hebrew boys are going to do later on. We know about the fiery furnace and all of that. We know that they have a dedication to God that is just unbelievable. But Daniel throughout is going to use his gifting that God has given him to pave the way for God's history to unfold. Now, at the end of the days that the king had said, after 3 years are over, he's going to bring them back in, that the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. He lines them up. Here again, we don't know how many of these guys were there. But he's going to line them all up in front of Nebuchadnezzar after 3 years of feeding them the fat of the king. And the king communed with them. He's talking to them. And among all of them, all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. They stood out more than all the others. The king Nebuchadnezzar is an interesting guy because not only does he know what he wants in his palace, but he's going to take the initiative after 3 years to go and commune with these guys. Ever how many there were, he's talking to them. He's finding out how much they've learned, how well they may speak or how much they know, how they address him and his questions. He's questioning them on all these things that they should have learned. And these four individuals that refused the king's meat and refused the king's drink, that stayed with God, these four individuals stood out more than all the rest of them. None of them could compare to what these guys looked like and what they sounded like. What was not in our scripture in verse 16, maybe, it basically says they looked 10 times better than the other guys did that were eating the meat, all right? So they automatically stand out in their visual appearance. But then when the king Nebuchadnezzar communes with them, tests them, their knowledge and skills come out even greater than the others. So they have already stood out. So and in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them, here it is, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all of his realm. 3 years of knowledge, 3 years of education, you add that with what God has granted these four individuals, and the king could not stump them. He could not say anything that they didn't have an understanding and knowledge about. Even so more than it was better than all his own magicians and astrologers, the Chaldeans that he would raise up. This shows you the favor that God had upon these young men who took a stand. Now, in my few minutes, what we want to understand in when we talk about Daniel and his predicament. Daniel, when you talk about 70 years of captivity, if today's time, that's like spending, if you went to Babylon in the 1950s, and in today's world, in 2026, you're still there. He spent his whole life in Babylon, basically, until Persia overtook him, and we'll talk about that later. But the story of Daniel is that he was a very young man, 16 or 17 years old when he was taken. we don't know how much of God's miracles, of God's knowledge, of all these things that he knew at a young age, and taken out of the only country he's ever known, taken out of the world that he was raised in, and put in a world that was completely physically and spiritually and everything foreign to him. Here's this 16 or 17 year old boy who is in a completely different world, surrounded by completely different ideologies. And he's basically living in a time where he's having to make a decision. Do I conform to my new reality? Everywhere around me, everybody is different. Where is God in this? You know, he could easily have said, why did God allow our city, the city of Jerusalem, to be besieged by this paganistic king? Why would God allow this to happen? Why would God allow all of us who are going to be the rulers of the city in the future take us out of our country? We loved him, but he took us out. Talking about himself, he could have easily become depressed, dejected, thinking that God had forgotten him, God had left him, and this is his new reality. And he could have easily turned his back on God and just followed what his instructions were. But even in a foreign land, he knew that God was God even outside of Israel. God was God even outside of the city walls of Jerusalem. He's 900 miles away. That's like if you started walking, 900 miles would put you in Oklahoma. He's that far away. And he still believes that God's in Oklahoma just like he was here, if you can understand what I'm trying to say. And in that understanding that God went with him, and God was still with him, that paints the picture of who this young teenager really is. He is a young man who is dedicated and knowledgeable and committed to God, so much so that he is willing in this new world to take a stand, to use what favor God has opened, the doors that he's opened up for him. And he is saying to himself, I'm taking a stand and I'm going to live for God in this foreign world. I'm going to be in a world that I don't love, but I'm not going to be of the world. I'm still going to have my relationship with God while I'm stuck in this world that's foreign to me. And we'll see that time and time again throughout this time of Daniel and as we speak with it. My time's up. Got to go. Next week, we'll get into some historical knowledge that Daniel's going to reveal to King Nebuchadnezzar. So we'll see you then.